Hello.
Hello.
Hey, girl, can you hear me?
I can.
I hear you too. You know what? I'm going to turn this volume down just a bit. We're on like Donkey Kong.
All right, here we go.
Well, welcome, everybody. This is Sharon Lee Sabatha, hostess of Middle Finger Happiness Podcast. Work hard, live well, don't fuck with me. That's the same title of my book. And it's on Amazon and the same as my little tattoo that I have on my arm. Definitely stories of struggle and the comeback. That's the whole purpose of having the podcast, is to enlighten and help people by telling other stories from other people. And so I have a guest that I met in Clubhouse, and then we had a great phone call, and I have to have Joe Deb on. So I have Joe Deb from Concord, New Hampshire. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Sharon. Yes, my name is Joe Deb. I am an artist and a liver transplant thriver. So that is my comeback story.
So the word thriver, because I was like, I'm taking notes because I always take show notes. So I'm like, liver transplant survivor? No, thriver. I like that.
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah.
Well, we're gonna peek into all your stuff because you have a lot going on, and you're just one of those sparkly, shiny people in a dark world. And you're also a court appointed specialist, special advocate for CASA.
That's correct.
So this is the magic question, and we just roll with it. You know, who are you, and what do you do?
Sure. So, previously mentioned the liver transplant. So 3.5 years ago, I was in liver failure out of nowhere. I guess looking back on it now, I can determine that I was ill, but didn't know I was ill. Didn't go to the doctor, you know, I had a little bit of pain in my upper abdomen, which is abnormal for anything related to the liver. So I don't want to freak any of your listeners out and have them think that any time that their belly hurts, that they're in liver failure. But for whatever reason, I did have some pain, and I was, self-medicating with handfuls of ibuprofen.
Oh, wow.
Message to your listeners. Handfuls of ibuprofen are never, ever a good idea.
I know. They're not. And so, I mean, I've had my appendix removed, but what was the pain like when you say, pain?
I had pain in my upper right quadrant of my abdomen, which is where your liver is. However, WebMD was telling me that... that you don't have liver pain, and that it was my gallbladder. And you're not gonna technically probably die from a gallbladder, maybe. And so I worked a high stress job, and it was, you know, we live in a world where we just go, and I just kept ignoring myself and not taking care of myself. And I was a little overweight, and terribly embarrassing to say that I was too ashamed to go to my doctor and have my doctor say, well, if you lose a little weight, maybe you wouldn't, be so uncomfortable all the time.
Oh my gosh. Why are we like that with ourselves?
Oh, I mean, it's awful.
I've been there.
It's terrible. So I didn't go to the doctor. And then, I went into full blown liver failure. Went to, regular day on Friday work. And then over the weekend, my girlfriend said to me, your eyes look yellow.
Oh my God, Joe Deb.
I know, so bad. So then Monday morning, I'm thinking, I don't feel bad. So it can't be an emergency. So on Monday morning, I call my doctor's office when they open up and said, I think I have a little bit of yellowness in my eyes. And they guided me to go to the emergency room, they said they were going to have me come in. They didn't actually think of it as an emergency either, but they knew I was going to need blood work. So
okay.
They directed me to the emergency room, and I was admitted that day. That day we were talking transplant right away.
Wow. So how fast did they do like test on you right there and then? And they're like, okay, this is what's going on.
Yeah. So what they do is they determined that yes, that my liver was not functioning barely at all. But the liver is pretty remarkable and can heal itself. So, you know, the talk was, well, you know, you can't drink wine anymore. You got to ditch the ibuprofen, and, you know, we're going to have put you on a low sodium diet to try to clean out some of the, fluid that you're carrying around your middle, and, you know, these different things that they were going to try to do to almost like reset the liver and have it start itself back in.
Oh, wow.
But they said, you know, and of course, well, what if that doesn't work? Well, then we would be talking about a transplant. So I couldn't even wrap my brain around that. I said, I'm thinking, I went from a regular life 45 minutes ago to you're telling me that I might have an organ transplant. No, that doesn't happen in real life.
And oh my God.
I know, crazy. Well, fast forward, and I didn't, my liver didn't reset at all.
So how long did they give you to reset when you say, okay, I'm going to reset? Was it a week,
yeah,
2 weeks?
So they don't really do that. It's very vague. But I was in the hospital for a while, then they sent me home, and, I went in, and that was in July of 2016. So then that, late summer and fall, I was kind of in and out of the hospital, not really truly going down the liver transplant road yet, but that was always on the back burner. But it's not as easy as they portray on, say, like Grey's Anatomy, where you're sick and you get on the transplant list.
No, there's a whole protocol. I had a friend who did. Somebody's got to be there to take care of you afterwards.
Yes.
There's all this. Yes,
it's true. It's true that it is. It is not what you think. And so, it took me from that time in July until January 23rd of 2017 is when I became officially on the list. So, but I had to go through a whole bunch of hoops. You know, you have to go through counseling, you have to see a social worker, and that's the whole part that you're talking about, where they do an evaluation to make sure that you have support.
The support.
Yeah. Actually, a person in my town that's a refugee from Africa, he had some liver disease, and he was initially turned down because he didn't have any family here, but his church stepped up and said, oh, no, we will be round the clock taking care of him. And so the organization that evaluates whether somebody is eligible for the list, the transplant facility, which is not in New Hampshire, it's in Massachusetts, begged them to reconsider. And they did. They reconsidered, and he ended up getting a liver, and he's doing well. But yeah, so that's true. That is a true thing. Where
You have to have the support afterwards, because you're bedridden. I mean, your body. Now, I have a friend who has had a heart transplant. Now she's on the second one. She's waiting because her
heart.
I'm
sorry to hear that.
She's had it 15 years.
I listened
32.
To that episode, actually. Yes, I did.
She's a hoot.
She is a hoot. She's got some spirit.
She's an amazing woman.
I feel
so
for her
long?
That she has to do it over again, though.
And well, because also what's making it hard is because of COVID, she said, you know, you can't get a transplant like you could easily years before.
Yeah.
So how long do you have your liver?
So, actually, you know, I've asked that question myself, and they don't, it's very strange. I don't think they want you to know, because I asked them that, and they really don't give me an answer. But I do know, Sharon, that I have a clock ticking. So I do have a ticking clock, and I'm 51. So I'm actually pretty young on the liver transplant scale that is not related to, say, a birth defect or, some weird mushroom that you ate and your body went into some weird toxic shock or something like that, which happens. I'm pretty young for my liver to fail. So when I'm surrounded by other transplant people, I'm by far the youngest one in the room most of the time.
And was it a male that donated?
Yes. How did you know that? Did I tell you that?
No, I was reading your bio.
Oh, yeah.
Which led me to, when you get a heart, men can receive a heart from a man or a woman, but a woman can only receive from another woman because it's a small heart. Our hearts are smaller than men. And so, so I guess a liver, you could get a male or a female.
I guess so. I wasn't, again, I don't know if I don't remember it correctly from before, because when you have liver failure, you have something that is called, I think people would call it brain fog, but we call it liver fog. Your body has high levels of toxins that cause your brain not to work very well. And so there's lots of things that I can't remember really. But I also know that there's certain things that they didn't tell you. And I think that part of that reason is because they try to keep you calm. I found something out after my transplant that apparently my husband knew, and they didn't, they said, you know, you probably shouldn't be sharing this with her. And what that is that in New England where I live, 25% of the people who are waiting for a liver actually die on the list. And so
oh my gosh,
those odds aren't that great. And so I'm glad I didn't know that, because I probably would have been wallowing. And I don't think I had enough bandwidth to wallow. I was really, my kids were, my son was in high school, and I was missing out on his high school. He's a hockey player, his high school hockey career. And he was a fairly good hockey player, and I was missing it. And our daughter was in grad school, and
life was happening. Yeah.
And so right. I was worried I wasn't going to see our daughter get married, and she had a very significant boyfriend, and he's still around. And, you know, those kinds of things were happening. So I didn't want to think about dying really, but we had the hospice meetings, and we were getting ready to do hospice. And because my kidneys,
and how does that feel? Can you tell our audience, how does that, well, you know what, you said something very profound. Your clock is ticking. Girl, all of our clocks are ticking. We don't get to say when. I mean,
it's true.
Every day is a gift. And more so when you get an organ transplant, you think differently now.
Yeah,
I'm sure you look at life differently.
Yes, it's not to sound cliche, and I say this, I don't want to sound cliche, but I am a cliche. Like, <it's>, cliches are there for a reason. You know, I do have this second chance at life. And so it's almost like magnified. I have this second chance at life. So I see my world through a different lens. And on top of that, I have an organ that won't last forever. So it's all like this big, bright, shiny world that I want to wallow around in and bathe myself in and be present in and enjoy and love. And I don't have time for pettiness. I don't have time for, you know, I just don't have time for that anymore. And that's how I wish I was living before, you know, but, it's terrible that something so dramatic had to happen in my life to make me, you know, really not sweat the small stuff kind of thing and live.
And is this what kind of led you, because you're an artist?
Yes.
Or were you always an artist, or was that after the fact, after the transplant?
It definitely manifested in the way that it is now after transplant. I've always had a very creative side of my life. I've always been intrigued by it and embraced it. And I'm sorry, I shouldn't say the word embraced it. Enjoyed it. I enjoyed that creative side. I always liked making things. However, I grew up in a family of people who aren't like that. And, you know.
join the club.
Yeah. So it never really was a thing. Now, I don't want to say that it wouldn't have been encouraged if I had spoken up, because they would have let me do whatever I wanted. But it was this unwritten thing where you're going to go to college, you're going to be a professional, you're going to, you know, that's the kind of world that I grew up in, which is fine.
I think a lot of us did. We were just having this conversation yesterday with, I was interviewed, same thing, you know, go to school. Yeah. Because I know my parents didn't go to school. My dad went to trade school. So yeah, it's always that recipe.
Yeah.
So yeah. When you decide I want to be an artist, I knew that in kinder, I knew that. And so when did you realize, okay, I'm going to be an artist, and because your artwork is amazing, and I'm going to let people know in the middle right now, and we do it toward the end, but so people can, you never know when people are in the car, they're listening, and they got to get in the house or go to work, but so they can follow you on Instagram. It is at Creating Joe Deb. And then your website is also creatingjoedeb.com.
That's correct.
So you can find her there, and that's where your art is. So how did you decide, okay,
pivot.
With this new level, yeah, that pivot. There's the word. Yeah. When was the pivot?
So after my transplant, I never went back to that job, that high-stress job. I never even went back for one day. And I didn't have any sort of plan. I do still have some kind of physical things that are happening. They have nothing to do with my liver. My liver is fantastic. It's off the charts, rock star liver.
rock star liver.
It is a rock star liver. I'm telling you, my numbers are phenomenal. And I hadn't really figured out what I was going to do with myself yet because of some of these other physical things that I have going on. I do have some, you know, I don't even want to get down a downer, but I have some pretty bad neuropathy. I have both of my knees have to be replaced. Sorry. Transplant on the brain. They both have to be replaced, and I was actually getting ready to have one of them replaced last April, but then COVID hit, and so I was not having a surgery. They stopped doing elective surgeries, and then when they started back up, someone like myself was not eligible to do that. My transplant team is not allowing me to have any elective surgery during the life of COVID. So,
oh my goodness.
So I'm still living with knees that don't work and hands that sometimes don't work, but that's okay. The neuropathy is probably something that I'll have to live with.
And let our audience know what that means, because somebody's maybe listening. Yeah. And like, what is that?
Yeah, so it's nerve damage, and it is from being ill. I do have also some permanent nerve damage that's up a little further in my arm that they're not really sure what that came from, but it did come after transplant. When your body is ill with liver failure, it can happen to get nerve damage. So yes, from while I was sick, I did get some nerve damage, but it's okay. It's part of me now.
It's part of you. And I love how you just said you have a rock star liver. So do you eat differently? Do you do things a little, what's something that we should all be doing to have rock star livers?
Well, no alcohol. And that's kind of a bitter pill to take sometimes, but, it is. So it is what you, when you receive, yeah, and I can only go with what I received as a contract of when you receive a liver. I don't know what it looks like to receive any other organ. I'm assuming that the contract is the same. You sign this contract. There's things that you agree to not do, not smoke, not drink, no illicit drugs, no tattoos, things like that.
No tattoos?
No tattoos.
What?
Yeah.
Why is that? Is the ink bad for your liver?
I think it might have to do with the ink, yes. And maybe that is a liver thing. I don't know. I kind of wanted to race right out and get some sort of tribute tattoo, you know, to having a liver and being this new person. But no.
Your tattoo. I have a rock star liver.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
And my family. I'm sorry. My family teases me about being in pain and that just go smoke some pot. It will make you feel better.
You can't do that either?
No. And oh, you know, and I have this thing about it, like, yes, but I promised I wouldn't. And so my husband will joke with me and say, what are they going to do? Come take the liver back.
Right. Oh, that's hilarious. So you've got this honor, you know? Super, you got this Bugatti liver.
Yeah.
You have to take care of it. Yes. Super awesome.
Super clean.
Oh my gosh.
I'm super clean. And then lucky me. So when you're waiting, I mentioned to you the low sodium diet. So
yes.
The first thing that you do after typically that you're off of that diet is you get to eat something crazy. I have pictures of me in the hospital after transplant eating pizza because pizza's my jam. And I couldn't eat pizza while I was ill. And I was so happy to eat it, but it made me so sick. And so I thought it was just because I was still, you know, in the hospital, not quite better. And since then, we've determined that I still can't have sodium.
So you know what? Your body is just going to tell you, don't give me this shit. And I want good stuff. I don't want bad shit. You know, that same thing happens to me. I cannot eat red meat. The older I get, I just cannot eat red meat. I get an upset stomach. And it's like, you know what? I'm just pretty much a chicken and fish person.
And don't you every now and then like really crave it though?
Yes. Oh gosh, like a really good hamburger. Yes. Occasionally I'll eat a 100% organically grass-fed burger, but it's even then I eat half because I'm afraid. You just feel awful. So, well, I'm going to switch gears because not only are you a rock star liver survivor or thriver, you and you're an amazing artist. It's beautiful artwork. You do something just keep on doing these amazing things. But you are, do I call you a CASA rep?
It's a CASA. We call ourselves CASAs. And that stands for Court Appointed Special Advocate. The CASA organization is a national organization. Different mm-hmm. states use them in different capacities. I'm not familiar with what Texas uses it as. However, I do know that Texas happens to have a pretty vibrant CASA population or usage. Mm-hmm.
No.
Are you familiar with it?
Definitely do. Yeah. Oh, yes.
One of my daughter's high school friends lives in Texas now, and she's employed by them. That's her job. She works for them. And she was, I believe social work was her degree or whatever, but she works for CASA. So she'll post things, you know, and she favorites my CASA stuff and I favorite her CASA stuff. But
Well, one of the things you told me that actually when we hung up, we spoke, I think, over a week mm-hmm. ago, was when people go to court for child abuse or neglect, the parents, the children don't get a representation. So this is where I did not know that. And I couldn't wrap my head around
it. It's interesting. You would think that the child would be the first one represented because they're the injured party. No, and there's no way a state would allow a parent, obviously, to not be represented because you're messing with their parental rights. And parental rights are very serious, and the federal government has made it very clear what parental rights mean. However, the federal government is the one that draws a line in the sand of when these parents need to basically get their shit together or they're in danger of losing. And that's only 12 months, which isn't very long.
And it's in some of these cases, I mean, because I have a friend who used to volunteer and he used to be a CASA rep, like things had to be really, really bad in order for the children to be taken away. But it's so sad that it gets to that point.
It is. If you and I were to imagine as parents what it takes to remove children, it's we would, you know, on the outside you'd be shocked, but now that I'm, you know, steeped in it because I do it, you know, I will be doing this until I can't, you know, physically can't anymore, because it has been the most rewarding thing other than parenting my own children that I've ever done. I get way more out of it. I So just to give your listeners a little idea of what I do, and if anybody was interested, you know, hopefully I would maybe spark somebody's interest in becoming, and anybody can reach out to me, DM me on Instagram, and I'm happy to talk about what it means. What I do is I get a case, and I get to know the child, spend time with the child. I speak to their teachers, to their preschool teachers, to their daycare teacher, to their counselors, to the foster parents, to the parents. You end up getting to know the parents quite well. And I struggle with my bias, and I struggle with checking in at the door. But typically by the end of a case, if a parent has done what they're supposed to do, you almost are a little cheerleader for them, because you're impressed with what they've been able to accomplish. Because, Sharon, quite frankly, lots of times what's happening is these grown adults, this is how they were treated as kids, and this is how they were raised as kids. And
right, it's a cycle.
And so you stepping in and having the ability to help these kiddos is the number one priority, of course, but you're also helping an adult kind of track their life differently and figure themselves out for probably the first time in their whole entire lives. It's pretty amazing to see what they can accomplish. It's fascinating.
So one of your cases, or are you allowed to talk about that? Or is this all, of course, to be confidential? We're not asking for names,
sure.
But what is one of the most, what's the word? I would just kind of be a sensitive topic. Most heartstring pulling situations that you had to represent?
All right. I will speak very generically. I will say that the most heartstring pulling case is a case of kids who were found to be in a car with their father's girlfriend with guns, knives, dirty heroin needles, and a loaded heroin needle that was ready to go, and all sorts of other paraphernalia that goes along with that. And they were in a hotel parking lot, and when they went into the hotel room that was registered under their name, there was so much paraphernalia. And the case of that is both parents being addicted. Mom hadn't seen the kids in years. These kids basically had grown up their whole lives with addicted parents, and they were teenagers.
Oh my goodness.
I know. So, can you even imagine the effect of a teenager being in a car with a heroin needle with your parent? Like, to me, the thought of that is that, you know, how are they ever going to say no to drugs, these kids?
Well, it's around them.
Yeah.
And the two things can happen. They either go down the path and say, well, look at my life, or they completely somehow get away from it because they say, look at my life.
Exactly.
It's two ways. I had some cousins that grew up like that with my uncle, who's now deceased. He was not a good person. And, you know, one went this way and did much better with her life. The other one, he's not even around anymore because he thought he didn't have a choice. And you know what? I don't even think CASA was, you know, when was CASA started? That's a good question. What year?
I'm not sure. And it's a state by state thing when states started adopting it. I want to say New Hampshire, it's been 25 years that CASA has been involved in New Hampshire, but I could be wrong.
So you had mentioned to me that in our telephone conversation that we had, when you have a case, you represent the child.
Correct.
In the courtroom. Mm-hmm. So are you, like a lawyer or like facts? No. Or like they don't have a lawyer?
They don't have a lawyer. I am a layperson. In the state of New Hampshire, however, I have the same exact rights as an attorney. So I'm a full party to the case. So I read every piece of discovery. I know exactly what's going on, and all passport documents have to be, you know, we all are involved in every single aspect of the case. I have just as much say as the state and just as much say as the parents' attorneys. So that's written into the statute of law in the state of New Hampshire, which is fascinating. But so when you asked that question before, I think we were winding down, the training that ACASA goes through, it sounds kind of overwhelming. Like, how could you do that? How could you go stand up in court and represent these kids? How do you know what to say? How do you know what to do? The training is pretty developed as far as what to teach you in order to prepare you. The support system that's around me is amazing. My direct line person that I go to, she's called my project, not project manager, that's my husband's job, my program manager. She is actually an attorney. That's not necessarily typical, but she is an attorney. So I have her as a great resource to bounce things off.
Oh, wow.
But the organization supports you and comforts you, you know, like comforts you, puts their arm around you and makes sure that you know and you're not out there on a limb by yourself. There's plenty of preparation.
So are there resources for you? Because I'm sure for you it's stressful. Are there avenues for you to receive any type of therapy yourself so that you, because it's a, you know, as humans we absorb all this, all the things going on. So how do you, when you get home, you know, do you meditate? You know, how do you continue being that superstar?
Yeah,
I have a rockstar liver.
So for me, I think it might be a little different than other people. I am a pretty emotional person, and it was either do this or become a foster parent, because I would love to take these kiddos all in. And my husband drew the line and said, "Listen, I don't think you could let them go if you had to let them go." And so, you know, maybe someday I'll get down that road. But for me, I also have a therapist daughter. She's a licensed clinical therapist, and I bounce a lot of stuff off of her, and she helps me kind of disseminate things. But that's a genuine thing. And CASA supports different avenues for self-care and would highly recommend therapy if we ever needed it. But mm-hmm. That being said, again, it's most of the time it's rewarding. Most of the time you're figuring something out for these kids. You know, my personal cases have all so far, you know, nothing's perfect. You know, like the state says, or this is what CASA says. The state says that the parenting level has to be a D minus in order to qualify as a real parenting. Whereas you and I, you know, our standards would be an A, you know, so you have to kind of temper your expectations a little bit, because these cases, most of the time, they're not going to be what you or I would consider a super parent. But I have to say what I've encountered so far, I've been fortunate enough that my parents have been solid B's. I've gotten them up to solid B's. So
B's too funny. But you know, I think this whole thing is all full circle with your liver transplant, and now you know, like you said, you're clock is ticking, but all of our clocks are ticking. And so I, like you said, we don't live like this, and I'm guilty of it. I just have some days you just think, oh well, you know, I can finish this up tomorrow. But then you're like, wait a minute, what if there's no tomorrow? What if today was the last day, and this is the last thing that I said to someone or did? And so now you have this, like you said, this second chance. And I mean, I don't know, you're just like a superhero. I don't know if they ever told you that.
I don't know about that. I just I don't know. I don't know if I would be considered a superhero, but I'm doing my part to try to make the world a better place and to help kids. You know, that's what I'm trying to do. And the art thing is like, for me, the art thing is this person that passed away, right? And I received part of their life, part of their being in order to survive. And while that person was dying, their family affirmed their decision to become an organ donor and confirmed right. it and agreed with it and chose for the donor, the organs to be donated. I feel weighty from that. Like, that's a powerful choice and a powerful decision. And so I feel that I'm just going to do it. I'm honoring this creative side of me. I'm doing it. The pandemic kind of forced my hand because I was bored out of my mind. And I just mm-hmm. started painting, and it felt good. And it just felt amazing because I had done some other types of art things in the past that were just, they felt great, but I was never there. I wasn't there. That was like a side, right. side gig, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah. But now, cause I'm looking at your artwork online and it's gorgeous. Oh, like your soul is inside.
That's what it.
It
is.
You
it's
can
my
tell.
Heart.
Yeah.
It's
your heart and soul.
And so I create happy, joyful art to express my grateful heart. That's how I describe it. But I'm telling you this is like I put on a pair of glasses and the world came into focus. I figured out where I'm supposed to be, what I'm supposed to do. Mm-hmm. I figured out, why do I cry at a commercial? Because I'm an artist and I think about things that way.
Oh my God, I'm the why same do, way. In fact, I can't.
Why do
we're like so sensitive?
Yes, why do colors make me like giddy? Because I'm an artist and that's who I am. Mm-hmm. Why do I mm-hmm. read into song words and movie words? And when I read a book, I'm just so into these characters that they rumble around in my head for months after because, you know, they're there inside of me because I'm an artist.
Artists are very, we're weird in
yeah.
a good way.
Yeah,
I can't explain it. We are definitely different. Yeah. And it's sometimes it takes either getting older and accepting that or a tragedy or completely pulling yourself out of a, you know, for me, I had to unplant myself out of a unhealthy relationship with my mom and go, come on, this is who I am. I know I was born to do this. And so that's the whole point of middle finger happiness. It's that, you know, that F it moment, like, okay, I've got a second
yes.
chance, or I have the comeback story. What can I do? What can I do in the next 30 years, you know, or the next 25
I have
years?
To say, I heard you say, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I heard you say about your mom and about mm-hmm. when she would, you know, say to you, this isn't, you could do better, or this isn't going to make you money, or whatever she would
oh,
say.
Oh, yeah.
I have to say that moment of thinking I'm not good enough, or, you know, how dare you call yourself an artist? You didn't go to art school. You don't know it. You know, that
yeah.
kind of stuff. So I had
oh,
that,
yeah.
of course. And in the past, people wanted me to do things that were kind of arty, that few people that knew that I kind of had that side of me. But I was like, no, I'm not an artist. Who am I to call myself an artist? And now, like you say, I'm like, fuck it. I'm an artist.
Oh, yeah.
I am
an artist.
And I don't care if you mm-hmm. don't think I am. And I don't care if people are saying behind my back, who does she think she is?
I'm an artist with a rock
yes,
star liver.
That's
damn
who
it.
I am. That is who I am.
I love yeah. it. Well, I know people that are going to listen to this. They may even listen twice because it's just an unbelievable story. This is not a normal talk. I mean, it's just different. It's very different. And that's why when we had our conversation, I was like, I would love to have you as a guest on my podcast so it can inspire someone else. You know, everybody is struggling with something.
Sure.
Everybody, whether it's a small trauma or a big trauma. And at the end of the day, no matter how much therapy we have, it does boil down to us making that next step and having that self-belief. But we don't have it, so we have to borrow it from people who have rock star livers like you and go, okay, I think I can do this. If you know, if Joe Deb can do this.
I love
so,
it. I love it.
Yeah. Well, we're going to wrap up here, but I want to make sure everybody can, one more time, where they can reach out to you. What is your Instagram or any of your other social media?
My Instagram is at creatingjoedeb, and my website is creatingjoedeb.com. And if anybody wanted to email me, I'm joedeb@creatingjoedeb.com.
Love it. Well, I appreciate you being here, and I learned a lot. I think you hit some notes, especially like you said, you know, your clock is ticking, but everybody's clock is ticking. So again, I can't thank you enough for being on the podcast. In fact, I'd love to have you back.
I'll come back whenever you want me to, Sharon.
I will love to have you back. So thank you guys for listening today, and I appreciate this. If you love what you hear today, please share it. You know, also give us a review if you liked it. And again, one more time, Joe Deb, thank you for being
here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.